Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Super awesome to like have you on. And so I found you, just so that people know, I found you because I found this really cool post, authentic post that you made on LinkedIn about making a transition from your past life, which is working with robots in the ocean, which I want to ask you about because super fascinating field, and then into some new stuff. So maybe we can just talk about like your experience with, I think the company was SoFar Ocean Technologies or Open ROV, you know, start from the beginning. I don't know a whole lot about the ocean. Actually, the ocean terrifies me. So I don't even like get close to it most of the time, but it's like a huge world. And, you know, in terms of robotics and ROVs, like I find that fascinating. I remember I fell in love with that stuff back when I was a kid, and they were just starting to do like exploration of the Titanic. I remember watching like the ROV go down and look at the Titanic, and it like blew my mind away. And then later on, who's the director? James Cameron. I think he went on to build some ROVs and visited like the Marianas Trench, which was also
he built ROVs, and that was an important part of Titanic, where the ROVs that he built. There's a great documentary called Ghosts of the Abyss about like, it's just a documentary of him and his team going down to the Titanic with the tools. And, but you know, he took a manned submersible down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. So he's a prolific, underwater, not just explorer, but also technologist. And we've had the chance to work with him on a few things, and he's the real deal. I mean, he's really just brilliant, in terms of, you know, actually understanding the nitty gritty of the technology. So let me answer your question, though, which is, you know, kind of tell you about that world. And I've been in the ocean tech space for about 10 years. And I got started very accidentally. And it actually, my path into that world reminds me very much of the path that you're starting on right now. With biology. And, you know, 10 years ago, I wasn't, you know, I didn't study engineering or science. I'd worked in some startups and spent a lot of my early 20s sailing around different places around the world, and got started in an unexpected way. My friend Eric and I were building a robot in his garage. He's an engineer, but we wanted to explore this underwater cave that had rumors of gold and treasure in it. And so we didn't have any money at the time, so we started tinkering and building this robot in his garage. And that project, you know, we ended up sharing it on Kickstarter. It was called Open ROV, and we sent, you know, kits and underwater robots all around the world. And we built that company and learned a ton about the shifting nature of kind of components and what's possible. And also kind of what's needed in understanding the ocean right now. So that's how we started the company. And then a couple of years ago, we merged with another startup to form SoFar Ocean, which is this really, you know, exciting new company that's building distributed sensing networks throughout the world's ocean and providing insights for conservation and industry. And the company's growing and succeeding and doing really well. And it's, you know, I've also kind of, I have some other interests. So I've kind of stepped back from an active day-to-day role there to pursue some new things. So yeah, I'm in the midst of this transition.
That's such a cool story. There's very few stories I could think of that start with, I started my company from a treasure hunt, a real life treasure hunt. Can you tell me more about that? Because I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of an excuse for us.
Where is this?
It was a gold up in the hills of the Trinity Alps in Northern California, and it was like an old gold rush story. We found this old magazine about this rumored treasure, and the story was so fun, and it was a real hook. Just the way that you're reacting to it is the way that everybody reacts to it. You know, they want to know if there's actual gold and did we find any gold? We didn't. But it was really an invitation into a bigger story. And I think there's a lot of folks who latched on to it because they were, because I think a lot of people are kind of aching for adventure in their life and kind of aching for this kind of ability to, you know, be hands-on and build something and get out in the world and explore. And, you know, we just tapped into that kind of broader desire, and it was powerful. And it's, you know, continues to be, you know, a formative kind of story in my life, but, you know, it's kind of, it was also a seed for so many other, ideas that have kind of grown out of that initial open ROV concept.
Yeah, it's interesting because you didn't get the gold that you were after, but you got gold in other ways. I mean, you started the company and presumably doing well today. Do you remember how old you were at the time?
It was 10 years ago, so I must have been about 25. Yeah,
that's really
exactly
cool.
25 so when we started.
So you were just at a place in life where you were doing a lot of sailing, and mm-hmm. you came across this article, and you had a buddy that was more technically inclined?
That's actually, I'll tell you, I'll go into it really specifically. And so I had been to a maker fair, which were these great events in San Mateo with all these makers. And, you know, I didn't think of myself as a technical person. And I just saw the passion that everybody had there, and I wanted to be involved. And from there, I met the folks who were starting a DIY bio space in Sunnyvale called BioCurious. And these were some of the original folks who were thinking about garage biology and, you know, kind of laid the groundwork for a lot of the stuff that you're doing today. Those were just ideas back then. And so I had volunteered to help them run a Kickstarter campaign and just kind of was generally just trying to be, you know, interested in and helpful and learn as much as I could. And they introduced me to Eric. They said, you know, there's a guy building a robot in his, or a submarine in his garage. You might want to meet him. And I said, sure, that sounds interesting. And it just, you know, just became a great friendship and a great partnership and collaboration. So yeah, that's kind of really where it started. It started in this kind of whole DIY bio scene.
Yeah. And are you comfortable talking about like what it is that the robot does or like what the company?
Sure.
Like, yeah. What's the application of the robot?
Yeah. So it's called OpenROV. It was called OpenROV, and ROV stands for remotely operated vehicle. And basically it's a camera and lights, and it's got a thin tether, and you can send it down and control it from your phone and see what the robot is seeing. And so, you know, a lot of folks call these underwater drones, which I think is kind of, which is fair. I think it's a kind of an easy comparison that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, so that's what we wanted. And at the time when we started building these things, they existed, but they were, you know, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000 machines that were kind of for industrial purposes. And, you know, we didn't have that kind of money. So, you know, that's why we started the company, just to, you know, build one for ourselves, but also for all the other people who, you know, might want them for whatever they were doing.
Yeah. And so who's the customer? Is the customer just like some guy that wants to get on his boat on the weekend and go exploring with a drone? Or is it commercial people that are looking for, I don't know, but maybe they're doing like, they're laying underground cables and they want to do inspection of those cables.
All of that. I mean, we never, you know, we kind of focused on the kind of the consumer aspect. And so like the, you know, something that was accessible for everyone to use. So it wasn't the industrial stuff stayed kind of more, you know, geared towards the expensive vehicles. But, you know, we found people doing all sorts of interesting stuff. The most, you know, the one that I loved the most was conservation, right? Like we found all these scientists and activists who were kind of using these tools to tell kind of visual stories about what was happening underwater and to, you know, make a discovery or to, ask a question. And so those were always the stories that were most interesting to me. And we had the opportunity to partner with James Cameron and a bunch of other foundations and donated, you know, hundreds, almost 1,000 robots to conservation groups around the world. So that was a really powerful powerful initiative that we had developed and undertook. Yeah, and it was called the Sea Initiative, and all those stories are actually documented on a National Geographic site that I can send you to.
Yeah, that'd be great. So you're partnered with probably a technical guy, I think is what you said, who sort of like really took ownership over the engineering of it. Where did that leave you in terms of your role within the company? And like, what's the thing that you're good at that you think helped make that company successful?
Yeah, you know, so Eric was a mechanical engineer. He was interning at NASA. But when we got started, you know, he was still working at NASA and not taking this as full time as I was. And so what I did, I had a real desire to learn. You know, these felt like skills that I wanted to learn. And so I had this idea for like creating a DIY education for myself, not dissimilar to the one that you've put out for yourself. And I called it my Zero to Maker journey. And I named it just like you named it. And I was writing blog posts for Make Magazine about it. And I was taking classes at tech shop and welding and electronics and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, I got this kind of crash course of tool use, right? Like, so it was kind of a way for me to really understand what was going on, what we were building, and how we could potentially build it. And I think that was really helpful because it helped us get exposure to this whole community of makers. And, you know, those were the kind of early customers who, you know, helped not just buy the kits that we were building, but, you know, spread the word about it and make contributions. And we hired a lot of them. And, you know, it was a really kind of vibrant ecosystem. And so, you know, but your question was, what do I do? And for that, you probably, you know, it's tough to answer that myself. I think you'd have to ask my teammate, Eric. But, you know, there's a ton, when you're organizing a community and running a company, there's lots of stuff to do, right? And so my job was kind of always shifting in terms of, you know, setting up support channels and, you know, hiring people and, you know, finance and, you know, all the stuff that kind of goes with running a company. And it was interesting because I got into this kind of wanting to be more hands-on, and it turned into a business and kind of writing emails and doing all the stuff that you wanted to get away from it in the first place. So, you know, it's interesting, but I would say that I'm a writer and that I'm a community builder and that, you know, kind of a dot connector. That's kind of what I think I do.
It's funny because my impression of you is someone who you're very cautious about not branding yourself as super technical, but you actually have a lot of technical information and insight and experience behind you. So it makes me think that maybe you hold this like bar in your mind of like, here's where I think actual engineers and technical people are, and here's where I am. I'm down here. But yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I think for me, it's like, you know, and I'm doing this right now with science. Like I'm kind of seeing a lot of similarities between the maker world 10 years ago and this kind of outsider science community of people who are on the kind of the edges of academia. There's a lot of similarities. And so I'm doing something similar there where I'm starting over again and I'm asking questions as a beginner. How do you ask questions? Where do your ideas come from? How do you do research? What tools are you using? And I think there's a lot of power in approaching something as a beginner and being kind of just kind of humble about your ignorance and aware of it. Because what you'll find is that people are willing to help. And people are willing to,
people want to help. They want to support the underdog too.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, it's a wonderful, for me, it's just been a wonderful way to approach the world. And to approach kind of new disciplines. And what I've also found is that when you do that, honestly, I think you find places to be useful. And that's kind of what I'm interested in now is figuring out ways to be useful to the scientific community, because I am really kind of concerned that science has a problem that they can't articulate very well. It feels like there's a blind spot. Science has a blind spot around some of the foundational problems. Like, we're going to have a vaccine. When we have a vaccine, people are getting it right now. And, you know, half the country isn't going to take it because they don't trust science. And to me, that's a huge red flag that we are at risk of. There's foundational issues that are at risk of setting us back. I mean, we're making so much incredible progress. How do we make sure that progress and that feeling of accomplishment is shared by everyone, and this kind of understanding of what the scientific project is and how we can all play a role in that is accessible to more people? And so, you know, that's my hope, is that by approaching it as a beginner, that I might be able to uncover some new ways of explaining things and new ways of doing things that are useful to those of us who are on the outside of the academy.
Yeah, you touched on some really deep things that resonate very closely with me and the journey that I've been on. I think my experience, and I don't know if this is similar to yours, but we both come from an industry where we were sort of super dedicated to it for a decade or more. Mm-hmm. And I'll speak for myself. I'd sort of reached levels, if you want to think hierarchically, that I never thought I would reach. And then when I got there, mm-hmm. I didn't feel satisfied. I didn't feel all the things that I thought I was going to feel all those years of working really hard to get to that point. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like a mirage. I finally sort of reached this spot. And I was sort of left at this place, this really awkward place where I was too qualified to do a lot of things, but I didn't really desire to do the things that on paper I was qualified for. So mm-hmm. I sort of felt like, where the hell do I fit in now? Because mm-hmm. I'm too old to do a lot of the stuff that I would have done before. Mm-hmm. And I don't really desire certain other aspects of, call it executive leadership, mm-hmm. Because I've done those things and I had very challenging experiences with some of them. And I think for me, it was really a challenge, and sometimes it's still pretty much battle with it, of like, let me humble myself down to killing my ego. I am nothing. I am starting mm-hmm. over. Mm-hmm. I know nothing about DIY bio. There's so many things about this stuff that I've never done before. And I go on Instagram and I'm connected with people like Damon Tai and just so many like amazing mycologists and people into the DIY bio space that are just doing incredible things. I'm like, I'll never be like as good as they are. Mm-hmm. Why should I even try? Mm-hmm. But there, as you said, you know, it's hard. It can be very difficult in the moment to remember that those years that you spent in the other field, they're still valuable. It's just it's a journey of discovering how to apply it in a different way, in a new space. And I think that's part of the journey that I'm on with Everyman Bio, that you're on with your new stuff that you're working on, is sort of like, how do I take who I am in my collective experience, but help it apply it to a new field is sort of outside of everything I'd been doing for so long.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think this is uncommon, to be honest with you. I think this is actually a really common human experience for people to come to a crossroads in their life and realize that they need to go in a new direction. And you know, there's a book called Transitions by William Bridges, which is kind of a classic, you know, 50-year-old book, and that they give to folks who are like us and making these transitions. And, you know, he talks about this, that there things end, whether that's relationships or jobs or careers, and then things kind of fall apart. And there's this kind of neutral zone where it doesn't really make sense. And then eventually you come out of that and there's a new beginning. So, you know, I think that these are really natural things. Our culture doesn't have maybe the ritual that we need to have for it. But it's something that's a really natural thing. And I'll tell you, like, I've had experience with this before, right? Like I lost my job and started Zero to Maker and kind of rebuilt from nothing. And then before that, you know, after kind of college, I decided that's when I had studied business, but I realized like I really wanted to sail around the world. So I left, you know, I left a job then, and, you know, I'd never been on a sailboat. And so, you know, I begged my way in this job at the sailing school and kind of reconfigured my life and, you know, spent a lot of my early 20s sailing. So I've done this a couple of times where I've like left behind the life that, you know, I had and what everyone thought I was going to do and started something new. That being said, it doesn't make it any easier, right? Like when you're going through these things, like all of your kind of deep insecurities kind of get kicked up.
And 100%.
And the other thing is like, it's scary. Like, you know, you don't know, like, if you're going to make an income like you did before and all these, there's all this, there's just clouds of uncertainty that go through it. But it's also a real thrill, right? Like if you can stomach that and you can tough it out, and, you know, it's not open to everybody all the time, right? Like there are certain life circumstances that don't allow for these kinds of moments. But if you get one and you feel like you can stomach it, gosh, it can be really meaningful and be surprising in surprising ways. So so when I see folks like you who are doing it, I get excited and I kind of salute the effort, because I know that by committing to a process, which you've done, right, like you're doing this publicly, you're going to get somewhere. I don't know where it is, but you're going to get somewhere. And it's probably going to be interesting. And so I'm excited to keep watching and to see where your journey leads.
I am too, man. And the thing that kind of jumped out at me that I think makes these things a little bit difficult is it's always easy in retrospect to kind of go, oh yeah, that's a transition point. You had an old part of you had to die so that a new part could be reborn. I think the part that I've struggled with is it's not always obvious when that's happening, because for me, I cling, you know, probably part of human nature is like clinging so hard to the thing that you're used to, to the thing that brings you safety and comfort, and other parts of you begin to evolve and kind of move away from that. But while they're moving away, they're just grasping on to the old parts like as hard as possible. Like, I don't want to let go. And that transition is so hard. It's not always obvious, like, to just kind of go, you know what, this is a transition point. I just need to commit to it. I'm going to turn off the old stuff, be focused on the new. It's really been a struggle to make that transition. And it's funny because you said you've done it a couple of times. I haven't. This is probably the first time it's like a very significant transition, but you say,
hopefully the first of many, right?
Hopefully some parts first of many.
Yeah. Right. You know, some of these things get forced on us, and sometimes they're of our own creation, and there's a real art to it. There's a real art to being able to kind of put the fear aside and to really hold on to the things that are exciting. And I think you're doing a good job of it. So keep up the good work.
Thanks, man. I mean, I will say, like you said earlier, not everybody can do it. So it is a blessing. And that's something I try to hold near and dear to me, is like, I have gratitude that I'm in a place where I can do this like exploration. That's a privilege. Like, sure. Especially in today's world, there's people out there who are like standing in food lines. I see the articles. So for me to be able to go, oh, I don't know who I am right now, I'm going to figure that out. Sometimes I feel like, oh, woe is me. I shouldn't complain at all, because that's a complete like first world problem privilege. So yeah. I am incredibly grateful that I can do that. And I feel like part of that gratitude is, and part of what I wanted to do with the reason why I wanted to do this publicly was because I want to help other people in whatever way. Figure out how to do it for themselves.
Sure.
Because like you said, in our culture, I don't really have anybody. There's no rituals. I don't have people I can look to who go, oh yeah, you're going through that normal transition that men or just people go through. I'm sort of figuring this shit out as I go along. So
sure, I
would like to sort of be put it out there, like even like I do tons of experiments and stuff where I completely mess up and things fail all the time, but I'm so comfortable now just putting that out going, you know what, I'm not claiming to be an expert and maybe you know how to do it. Tell me how to do it. And that brings me like so much relief and satisfaction and connection to people. And so the hope is that just by having all of this stuff be public, that it helps someone else out there realize like they're not the only ones going through it. And
So to that end, I mean, so I wandered into this DIY bio community like 10 years ago, like I said, and it was nascent then. There was BioCurious and GenSpace and maybe a few other DIY bio community labs. As you walk into this world now, where did you start? Like, what was your first point of entry?
Yeah, it's funny. 15 years ago, I remember I walked outside with my wife. I was living in Boston at the time, and we saw a little mushroom on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I remember going, just some thought came to me, which was like, what is this? What is a mushroom? Like, what is it? It's not, is it a plant? And I did a little like searching on the internet, and I found this incredible online community of people that grow mushrooms, mostly psychedelic ones. I had no experience with drugs or psychedelics or any of that stuff. So I was like, And when I started to see like pictures and videos of people creating like little labs in their house and culturing fungi, and I was like, whoa, there's a whole other world of science here that I'm not connected to. And I sort of got enthralled by it. And I spent maybe like a month or two learning how to grow shiitake mushrooms for my little apartment. And I grew them, and then it sort of died after that because I didn't know where to take it. But that experience stayed with me for over a decade to where I got to this transition point. And I decided, just like a lot of stuff happened in my life, and I decided, I had someone came to me and was like, I was really struggling with depression, and I was trying like everything that I could and nothing was really working. And someone said, you know, you should really look into psychedelics. They've been shown, like the studies out of Johns Hopkins has been shown, they've shown to have some real lasting impact on treatment resistant depression. So I was like, actually, I have a connection to mushrooms because I grew some shiitakes like over a decade ago. Let me like revisit that. So I did, and I grew some Psilocybe cubensis mushrooms, which are the psychedelic kind. I had a significant psychedelic experience with them, which taught me all sorts of things and exposed all sorts of things about myself that I had been neglecting and needed to give attention to. And it sort of led me into this path of like exploring biology and nature and connectedness in a way that I wasn't able to get from computer science and fintech, especially, which I love, by the way. I mean, there's a part of me intellectually that loves financial technology. And I used to write code that would transact millions and billions of dollars and deal with people's credit all over the country. So there's a sort of like intellectual satisfaction that comes from that. But as far as being connected to nature, that's like as far removed as it gets, because it's just bits and bytes and money and things that I would say don't really matter when it comes to your life satisfaction and happiness. So that's the nutshell, you know, story in a nutshell of like how I sort of got into DIY bio and all that.
Okay.
Stuff.
So that's interesting. You know, my introduction was these spaces and the people who were building these kind of new tools and this new infrastructure. But it sounds like your introduction and invitation was through questions you had about, you know, mycelium, the natural world, and questions you had about your own self, right? Like your biochemistry and your depression and things like that, and those kind of trying to connect those dots. I'm assuming led you to some of the infrastructure that has been laid out there. So you have these questions, and you're growing these stuff. Like what were your first interactions with the DIY bio community, or the people, or the spaces, or the tools? How did you find that stuff out?
Yeah. Well, let me step back for a second and say that I want to talk a little bit about connectedness, because that's very much related to like some of the stuff that we're talking about. And there's so much about like human psychology and even psychedelic experiences, which make them difficult in consciousness, which makes it difficult to talk about, because our experience of consciousness is subjective. So we don't really have a good reference point to talk about these things in concrete, discrete terms. Mm-hmm. So everybody's sort of like using our limited language capacity to talk about things that are like purely subjective and live in our minds. Mm-hmm. So before I really like did this transition and got into like the DIY bio and the mushrooms and all that stuff, I had been on a journey of like, I've been in therapy for 10 years. I'd been studying a field of neurobiology called interpersonal neurobiology, which is sort of a holistic approach to understanding how the brain works. Mm-hmm. How does the brain think, and what does well-being look like based in biology? And it does that by taking the disciplines from chemistry and physics, and taking, you know, all of these different science disciplines have people that are studying the brain, but from a chemistry perspective, from a physics perspective, from a philosophical perspective. And interpersonal neurobiology is a way of integrating all of those learnings into one place. And one of the big things that has come out of the research from interpersonal neurobiology is that people who self-report a high degree of well-being, when they scan their brains, they have a more even distribution of blood flow throughout their entire brain on average. And it implies that people who are more interconnected with all of the parts of themselves feel better. People who are depressed or struggle with addiction or have some other sort of psychological issue in their lives that's impacting their well-being, when they go and look at the blood flow of their brain under an MRI, what they see are concentrations of blood flow within the brain. For people who are depressed, for example, you'll often see a lot more prefrontal cortex activity in the front of the brain, because that's the part of the brain that's concerned with executive function and thinking about the future. And it makes sense intuitively. We kind of know this, like if you're depressed, it's often you're sort of ruminating about what's going to come in the future. And it can be very difficult to sort of break out of these patterns that you're in. And so there's a sort of theme in psychology of actually the more connected you can be with all the different parts of yourself, that the happier and the better your psychology will be, the higher sense of well-being that you'll have. And so if we hold that idea of interconnectedness with yourself kind of over here, and then come back and visit the DIY bio and mushroom space, there is a ton of stuff in the world of mycology of fungi and in biology that show that nature is healthier when all of the different ecosystems are more interconnected. There seems to be this sort of theme in nature around interconnectedness. People actually are more resilient and get along better and are happier on a larger context, at different social and societal contexts, when they're more interconnected, when energy can flow more easily between groups of people. Mm-hmm. So when I had this really big psychedelic experience, what I recognized about myself was that I had been stuck in a world where I was investing energy in just a couple of parts of myself. And there were other parts of myself that were sort of malnourished. And when I say parts of myself, I'm talking about my psychological self. You know, I have an intellectual self that's interested in learning, like just learning science. But mm-hmm. we all have other parts of ourselves that go beyond that. You're not just an open ROV guy that loves the ocean and likes to sail. You might mm-hmm. also like music. You might also like mm-hmm. having conversations with interesting people. You might mm-hmm. like to read books about something completely different. We all have these multifaceted aspects of our psyche. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be this like theme that I'm really interested in, that is sort of like, I think, on the cutting edge of neuroscience that sort of revolves around interconnectedness within yourself and within people and also within nature. And so while I know like from an outsider's perspective, it's probably the first time I've even tried to articulate these ideas, but you seem like someone who is interested in and can kind of get it. They're all very much related to me. And so this is giving me an opportunity to take these parts of myself, these parts of my brain that I used to go, no, that's not going to help you with career. That's not going to help you make more money. That's not going to help you climb the ladder. That's not going to help you be a successful entrepreneur. Now I can break down the barriers that were preventing me from giving energy to those places. And now I can sort of more evenly distribute my energy across all the parts of myself, which in turn allows me to be more connected to other people, to nature. And that in turn improves my well-being. But also, I think what's interesting is it also will, I think, and this is the part that's uncertain, will lead to something truly amazing in the wherever every man bio ends up. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that the connectedness part of it is really at the heart of sort of the journey and how it led me to DIY bio. And then the DIY space is, look, I didn't go to school. I dropped out of college. I went to school for electrical engineering. I dropped out and started working in tech at 19 and just hustled for over a decade, taught myself how to code somewhere in the middle of there. And just completely self-taught, like most software engineers are, actually. That's sort of the nature of the job because technology moves so quickly. Then there were a couple of people in DIY bio that I saw were doing genetic engineering and were teaching it on YouTube. And it dawned on me that maybe part of biology has gotten so abstract now that people like me who are like really interested and dedicated to it can self learn a lot of this stuff and teach it to themselves and do something incredible. And so far that's been true. I've been able to do some pretty cool stuff with DNA from my home lab that's behind me that I would have thought before the average person would never be able to do that. Who would have thought you could extract DNA and sequence it from your kitchen, you know, like run PCR. I never thought that stuff was possible. And now you can, you know, design a genetically modified organism and grow it in your kitchen. So like there's really a lot of stuff that you can do that sort of translates from my self-taught, you know, journey that carries over to the DIY space.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, well, you know, it sounds like a meaningful direction. And I think, you know, you're touching on a lot of things that are kind of important and trending in the right direction, right? Like the use of psychedelics and antidepressants and just kind of what's possible with the technology. I have a specific question that's kind of related to this, the theme that I've been exploring around doing science better. As someone who's not trained in science formally, how have you learned how to organize and run experiments or put together hypotheses and do all of that? How have you learned the scientific method?
Well, that's a great question. So there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is I just try to replicate notable people that are trained. I try to replicate how they do things. And part of that is being completely transparent with everything I do. So, you know, asking a question, proposing a hypothesis, I put it out there so that it can intentionally be challenged. At my core, I'm a huge believer in truth. So I think there's something about the scientific process, which is all about discovering the truth and making it known. And also, I'm skeptical in nature as well. And I think that also ties really closely into the science world. And like, even if I make an observation, I never presume to know 100% what it is that I'm observing. Even if I have a really good hunch, I always presume there's maybe 15 other possible reasons for this. Mm-hmm. So everything that I do is sort of postulating ideas and reasons, you know, observations and ideas about what might be the underlying reason behind those particular ideas. Like formally, I just read a lot of papers and try to emulate what real proper scientists are doing. So that, like, that's the short answer, is like, I'm always reading papers, trying to decrypt them, because they're often written in a very coded language. And that seems to be changing actually, which is great.
How do you have access to them if you're not working at a university? Just open access stuff? Is that the only stuff you're reading?
There's a lot of stuff that's open access, and there is another approach that a lot of people in the DIY biospace use. There's a website called SciHub.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the other approach. I'm not, you know, officially I've never used that site, but it is out there. I was about to say it's like a Napster but people probably won't even know what Napster is. I'm starting to show my age.
No, it's I think that's
like a Pirate Bay for academic papers.
For sure. Okay, so you know, so it sounds to me like you're doing a lot of the stuff that scientists do. However, that there's also things that you're doing that scientists don't do as much as you'd think, which is this idea of replication. And this is an interesting idea, because there's actually a replication, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's something called a replication crisis in science, where huge amounts of like literature in various fields, we actually can't replicate it. Right. And these are the citations that other citations are built, that other papers are built on. And so there's this kind of this weakening of the integrity of science. And this is a real concern. And scientists, as it turns out, are really not incentivized at all to replicate other studies, because those aren't the papers that are going to get published. And that's not the way to advance your career, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting to me that you, as an amateur, and I use that term with the
oh, I call myself an amateur. Yeah.
Yeah. The French meaning, right? The love, the doing it for the love of,
yeah,
of the thing. So that's interesting to me to hear that you, as an amateur, are spending your time learning through replication, as opposed to what most scientists are doing, which is writing grants and grant reporting.
That's sort of a luxury.
It's
sort of a luxury of the position that I'm in. And when I say replication, I should also say that what I'm really replicating are the, often when you read a paper, there's a tools and methods section. Mm-hmm. Inside of that are a bunch of methodologies that actually apply to all sorts of experimentation and scientific fields. Those are the things I'm trying to replicate. I'm not trying to actually like replicate their exact results for whatever specific experiment they were running. Are there some of that? But a lot of it is like, oh, they used PCR to extract this gene and amplify it. I can use that methodology for a lot of different things. And so I can learn how to do those things on my own just by looking at it, even if their experiment and their data was contrived because they were trying to get to a result to like get themselves published. Mm-hmm. And I agree, there are a lot of problems in academia. I would love to like dive into that a little bit if you feel comfortable talking about it. The reason why I even say like, if you feel comfortable talking about it, because there is a element of our academic system that has been corrupted, I believe. And I think it can be a contentious topic because it inevitably overlaps into politics and it overlaps into, so like sort of some some deep philosophical divides that I think are happening within society. Mm-hmm. And that has, in my mind, sort of contributed to a corruption of many of, I'll just say, America's great institutions. That sort of deeply concerning to me.
You know, I'm happy to, well, I you know, like, I'd probably stay away from the political stuff, but I will talk about like what I perceive the kind of the crises of academia. And this is not, the thing about it is, I don't think this is controversial. I actually think if you polled scientists, like if you had, if you polled 1,000 scientists, I think you'd find that 90% of them agree that there are major problems in academia. And there's it's not a short list of problems. It's actually kind of, it's you know, probably, there's probably a top 10 list of things that are not going well. But I think this incentive problem is at the heart of it, right?
It's the way that incentives, for sure.
And the way that money flows through science is not producing the, I don't know that it's producing the best possible outcomes. And so that's the kind of one that I've been focused on. But I also think there are problems with science that scientists wouldn't necessarily put on their top 10 lists, that are problems that are, you know, folks like you and I can kind of better articulate, because as outsiders who are actively trying to get in and actively curious people who are trying to get to the edge of what humans know and participate in that project, we're, it's hard for us. There are a lot of barriers. And I think we have a lens on, some of the problems that maybe those, you know, scientists in academia don't have. So those are the things that I'm like actually most interested in are, you know, trying to illuminate some of those blind spots.
Can you think of any off the top of your head?
For sure. Yeah. So I think one is the problem with the cost of tools, right? And this kind of goes back to some of the stuff we learned with OpenROV, was manufacturers aren't building low cost ROVs for scientific work just to improve the scientific mechanism, right? Like there's no, the scientists get their grant money and they pay high prices and there's limited runs and the manufacturers charge them high markup. And it's just kind of this circle that doesn't, it, no one's incentivized to create cheaper, lower cost tools. And this is true for a lot of the bio stuff, right? Like think about like the open PCR and open qPCR and all the innovation we're seeing in like the DIY bio space. But the idea of low-cost scientific tools is one that's been getting a lot of, you know, like attention. And I think there's a researcher at Stanford, his name is Manu Prakash, who's kind of pioneered this whole idea of frugal science, right? So he's invented a microscope that's, you know, a dollar to produce. It's called a foldscope. So lower-cost scientific tools are something that that hold a lot of potential. I also think science communication in general is a really misunderstood thing, right? Like, so at some point, like science, you know, moved into such specification in various fields that they realized they needed a whole different genre of a way to communicate outside of that field. And the way that science communication works right now is they think, oh, how do we communicate with the general public? Like, how do we have this like baseline, lowest common denominator explanation for things? And that's kind of, that dominates the way that science is communicated. And I don't think that's actually the right way to do it. But anyways, there are new fields like the science of science communication that I think are pointing out flaws there. But I still don't think we have a lot of invention around what could possibly come next. Should come next.
How much of the skepticism around the vaccine do you think is related to that communication problem that you just touched on?
I think it's related to the, I think it's definitely related to that. I think it's hard to like draw the the very specific line, like saying, because of this show on the Discovery Channel, I think that that contributed to, you know, 1% less people trusting or understanding vaccines. Like, it's hard to draw the direct lines, but there is a kind of a dumbing down of the way we talk about this like miracle of like science, which is this organized skepticism, this great project of, adding kind of rigor and documentation to our world. It's just misunderstood. So, you know, Carl Sagan in the book, The Demon-Haunted World, has a wonderful passage around his concern about the dumbing down of America and the kind of anti-science sentiments that he sees rolling up. But anyways, I've got ideas about how to fix it. However you want to take that.
No, this is one of those areas where I'm fascinated by and something that I think about quite a bit. And each of us has our own life experiences and our own perspectives. And I'll just say that my perspective, biased as it may be, has been that a lot of the skepticism around the vaccine in particular has been because politics has corrupted the idea of what it means to be scientific. I know a lot of people who are skeptical purely for political reasons because it was developed under one administration or the other. Mm-hmm. There's no scientific basis beyond just like the politicians, regardless of whatever side you're on, have begun to use science and wield it against, or however you want to, they wield it for political power. And that's incredibly dangerous to me because then the truth becomes so hard to find. And I'd say like concurrently, I just feel like our education system in general is failing to teach people to think critically, to really dig into like just to think with a scientific mind or a skeptical mm-hmm. mind. Instead, so many people are being taught to look to authority for like how to think. And authority turns around and says like, you should think like us because we're doing it for the right reasons. And so then like the truth gets lost in there because there's these sort of people that are operating on the wrong incentives and using and spinning science, propagandizing it to like meet their political need. So like, not that I definitely don't want to like go into like a political whatever, but I just think there's no way of getting away from the influence that has had on people's perception of science. And in particular, like the vaccine's a great example of that. I actually know how the vaccine works because there's a guy named Josiah Zahner from The Odin who like did a whole live stream on developing a vaccine. And they developed it, they got it made, and they administered it to themselves as just DIYers, mm-hmm. and explained how it worked. And once I knew how it worked, I was like, I'm not fearful. I will take the vaccine. I mean, I'm not completely naive in thinking that the government or the FDA or whoever develops vaccines are completely innocent and they could never harm us. Obviously, that's mm-hmm. a case. That's the case for any sort of medicine. But I don't have an irrational fear of taking the vaccine. I'll take mm-hmm. it. I'm more afraid of being told that I have to take it and being tracked. mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have any thoughts around that. I just think there's definitely like something.
Yeah, I think corrupt. I think like the political yeah, exactly, like the like, because I'm trying to think of the right word, like it's like the it's not so much that these have become political issues, it's like the process by which they become them is actually quite predictable. And there's there's interesting research that's just starting about this. I mentioned the science of science communication, right? So it's like, it's one thing to say, well, this is concerning, but it's another thing to say, well, why is this happening? Right. And you look at the, like, actually applying the rigor that you would expect for any kind of scientific question that you have. Why don't you turn that lens back onto that specific problem? And so when you do that, it's just starting to happen, right? There's been a few of these science of science colloquiums at the National Academies, and, you know, Dan Kahn's research at Yale is really compelling, and it's kind of, he's got these theories around cultural cognition rather than like we understand things as a group, and through our group, our group identity lenses more than we do just like rationally and through like the amount of evidence. So I think there's a lot of hope in trying. I don't think we're going to get out of this problem the same way that we got into it. And I think like the kind of calls for, well, people just had more education and people just got the facts and we just hit people with the facts.
No, yeah, you're right.
I don't think that's going to work.
It's not an information problem in the sense that people need more information. It's a almost like a filtering problem. How to read the information, how to look at it, how to pick it apart, I call it thinking critically, how to discern, how to test it.
so, but I'll tell you some interesting things about that. So I think when you give people science as a tool rather than a prescriptive set of results, you'd be surprised at what they're capable of. And so the example I think of is the Flint water crisis, right? Like, I don't know how intimate you were with what happened there, but there was, you know, clearly a problem, right? And the local government wasn't doing anything about this. And there was a group of moms, and Leanne Walters is kind of like emerged as like the most famous one, who were kind of fed up with what was going on. And they reached out to some scientists to help them organize and conduct actual studies. And they started using their results, and they started using science as a tool to get their message out. And then what was interesting, really interesting to me, is later on what happened when Mark Ruffalo and his water protectors showed up and started saying, oh, you guys can't bathe in this. And like, they started selling, they tried to promote this product and do all these things. That same group of moms kind of put up their hands and said, wait, what's the science you're talking about here? Like, what is, like, so it's not just a right or a left thing, right? Like, if you equip people with the tools, they're able to react critically to all sorts of like potential, you know, like misinformation, or, you know, people trying to take advantage of them. So I think we need to be talking more about science as a tool and a method rather than like science as a set of professionals who know better than everybody else, right? Like, I think we need to take back the word as a kind of a verb rather than a noun.
Absolutely. It's a way of thinking. It's a process. It's a tool. There's an element of humility that comes with it as well. Because you have to sort of, with any sort of scientific problem where you want to apply science, you kind of have to say, like, I don't have an answer for this, and I have to be open to whatever the results may show.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. So, you know, how do you do that? How do you communicate science as a method and not just a set of results? I don't know. I think there are lots of good ideas that we could try, and I hope more people start kind of experimenting and creating in this realm with a kind of really rigorous lens.
Absolutely. So closing up here, I noticed that you're these days, it looked like you were doing some advising on experiment.com. Is that something you could tell us a little bit about?
Sure. Yeah. So experiment.com is one of my favorite corners of the internet. It's a crowdfunding site for scientists. I also think this is one of those sneaky, effective tools for effective science communication. And they've, you know, almost 1,000 researchers have raised almost $10 million on the site. It's an amazing tool for, you know, funding smaller projects. And so I'm actually I would say I'm more involved than just it being an advisor. I've started this new organization called the Experiment Foundation, which you can check it out at experiment.foundation. And we're helping companies and foundations and eventually government agencies actually fund researchers on the site. So we got started with a really small grant from people who just believed in us. And this next kind of chapter of my life, I really hope to be about to being that same instigator and inspiration and enabler for lots of folks. So that's kind of the mission that I'm on right now. And if people haven't seen it, I encourage them to go to Experiment and poke around.
Yeah, I love experiment.com. Actually, I have a couple of ideas that I was thinking about throwing up there in the coming.
Oh, you should.
So I would love to like get your feedback on how to go about doing that, because it's sort of like a crowdfunding for science, which is kind of awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's even high school kids doing some real like science stuff on there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And you know, it's a great way to raise funding, you know, between smaller projects between 5 and 10,000, but it's also a really cool way to engage a community, right? Like the Open Insulin Project got started there, and there's just so many great stories, and we're just kind of starting to see all the kind of papers and the impact. But you know, I've seen it change people's lives, and there's not so many tools you can kind of say that about, and the experiment process is one of them. So I hope you do it. I let me know if you do. I'm happy to kind of coach you with my best wisdom so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And one last thing is, I read that you were doing a challenge grant for something called the Footprint Coalition.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, this is open for just a couple more days. We've got $10,000 of it. It's going to be distributed proportionately to projects for conservation technology. So the Footprint Coalition is Robert Downey Jr.'s new foundation, kind of setting out on some pretty innovative ideas around healing and protecting the planet. And so we're excited to partner with them on that. But keep an eye on Experiment, because I've got a long list of challenge grants that we're organizing for 2021. So, DOI biology and a whole bunch of funders who are stepping up to kind of back more projects. So stay tuned there.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, thanks so much for being on the podcast. If folks want to get a hold of you and ask you more questions or get connected with you, what's the best way for them to hunt you down?
Twitter is, I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's David T. Lang. And that's a good way to follow and message me there.
Okay. Awesome, man. Well, it was truly a pleasure, and I appreciate you being open to joining me on the podcast.
Anytime. I'm looking forward to following along with your journey.
All right, man. All right. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.